Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hays, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains and beyond. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful regions on the planet. Well, it's great to be back with you today for another episode of The Fern Line. It's been about a month since I released my last episode. I was down in Utah visiting family and having a bit of vacation in the desert. But I was also able to record a couple of great interviews while I was down there, one of which I'm featuring today. But before we get started, I want to thank everyone who's contributed to The Fern Line on Patreon this last month. As you know, Patreon members get exclusive content and merchandise, including stickers, original music, as well as the Patreon-only podcast, Beyond the Fern Line. But besides the extra stuff, what you're really doing is helping ensure that the podcast remains a viable and sustainable endeavor for me moving forward. So thank you so much for helping out with that. If you're interested in helping support the show, you can go to thefernline.com and click Support the Fern Line, or you can go to the Patreon website and search The Fern Line. Other ways you can support the show are by leaving a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app, or just by telling someone directly. Tell your friends, your climbing partners, people you think might dig The Fern Line, let them know it's out there. And finally, I want to thank the Alaska Rock Gym for sponsoring Season 1 of The Fern Line. The Alaska Rock Gym has been providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage area since 1995. The gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of bouldering terrain, beautiful locker rooms, and expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms as well. It's also just a positive and community-oriented space that has a great vibe. So if you're interested in finding out more about the Alaska Rock Gym, stop by anytime to take a tour or check them out online at alaskarockgym.com. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. In 1998, I experienced firsthand what it's like to be pounded by weather on Denali. I was 23 years old and somehow had talked my way onto a trip, working as an assistant guide on the West Buttress. The first thing the other guide told me was that if you scramble the letters of Denali around, they really spell denial. A few weeks later, I'd come to realize exactly what he meant. After 12 days of backbreaking load hauling, shoveling, and endless hours of melting snow for water, our team of six stumbled into the windswept high camp at 17,200 feet. Most of the clients were exhausted from the big carry, and although I didn't admit it at the time, I was reeling from acute mountain sickness. Needless to say, our snow walls were constructed hastily that day. That night, the winds hit. Initially, it sounded like a distant whistle, but as the inevitable freight train grew closer, I was overcome with a sense of foreboding. At first, the tent fly flapped gently, almost like waves lapping at a calm, sandy beach. But 10 minutes later, the violent gusts were cracking at the tent like a bullwhip, and we were in a life-or-death situation. Sometime later, a gust of wind, probably approaching 100 miles an hour, hit the plateau, disintegrating our snow walls and buckling the tents with vicious ferocity. Exchanging a wordless glance, me and the other guide put on our boots and sprung into action. We weaved the climbing rope over the tents like a spider web and secured those to pickets we'd welded into the ice. Luckily, it worked. The next 4 days were spent learning how to build real snow walls while enduring constant lenticular winds and Arctic blizzards. When the first sucker hole opened, we quickly retreated to base camp, followed by a flight into Talkeetna, where we gorged ourselves and celebrated getting down in one piece. Let's just say I learned a thing or two about the power of Denali's weather. Since my experience almost 20 years ago, a lot has changed on Denali. Climbers have better equipment, detailed topos and beta exist online, and folks can communicate with devices like InReaches. But one thing that hasn't changed is the brutality of Denali's storms. This is a lesson that Salt Lake City climber Aaron Kurland would learn firsthand in June 2017. Aaron and his partner Sam had initially planned an attempt at the formidable and rarely climbed father and son's wall, but when they found the face to be out of condition, they quickly turned their attention elsewhere. The duo settled on the ultra-classic Cassine Ridge, a 9,000-foot spine of ice, snow, and granite that snakes its way directly up the center of the south face. With a big storm scheduled to hit within the week, the duo planned a light and fast 3-day alpine-style ascent. Little did they know, they would soon be at the mercy of Denali's weather, totally exposed and fully committed on the Cassine.
So we descended down the West Rib. Everything went really well. It was like incredibly beautiful out. There were a lot of clouds, but the sun was poking through and, the down climbing was super easy. It was just, like basic down climbing. We didn't put in any pro, we didn't do any wraps. We just simul climbed down and it was really enjoyable. I think there was just this like overall sense of relief for both of us. Like we're away from all of the hustle and bustle at 14. There's like a lot of nervous energy there. So we got down to the base of the Cassine in about 5 hours after leaving 14 camp. There are definitely like some signs of the overall danger, like crossing from the base of the Chicken Couloir, which marks the end of the west or the start of the West Rib, to the Japanese couloir at the base of the Cassine, there's just like a ton of avalanche debris that kind of comes off the Seracs near the Seattle 72 ramp, which we chose not to take because it was super broken. And neither of us had been down that way. I think we're both like really, we had trained, like I said, Sam and I had quit our jobs before this trip. Sam was a nurse and I worked for Black Diamond here in Salt Lake. We were essentially just training and felt really fit and felt really confident in our partnership. And I think that was most of the sense of relief, just like being able to move together and not having to worry about anyone or anything else. Yeah. We just felt comfortable climbing together. So yeah, we're at the base of the Cassine. You know, I messaged our good friend Alan Russo, who Sam had been climbing with for about 3 weeks prior in Alaska, and messaged my mom. We had an inReach. Yeah, started up from there. So we just simul-climbed up the Japanese couloir in really deteriorating weather. So yeah, it was kind of just getting worse and worse the higher we got, and lots of debris coming down, lots of spindrift coming down. The winds are really picking up. So yeah, when we got up to the Cassine ledge, I was really hesitant to keep going because that's like the obvious point of no return. And I don't really say that lightly because I try to look at things from like a non-emotional point of view. But I did really feel like this route particularly, like once you cross the knife edge, like you're not going down. It's up and over. With the weather we were in and my experience in Alaska in the past, I just had this feeling that the weather was about to get really bad.
And the weather did get bad as the team hunkered down on the Cassine ledge for the next 15 hours. It was also during this time that they noticed the first potential signs of frostbite on one of Aaron's toes. But the duo decided to roll the dice, reckoning they could top out on the route before the really bad weather hit. As a result, frostbite would be the least of their worries in the coming days.
Yeah, so once we continued up, basically it's like game on. Like we're going to the top because after the Cassine ledge, you climb an easy pitch of snow, and then the Crux pitch, which is like I don't know, probably it's like 5'8" ish mixed climbing. Nothing crazy. The real kind of point of no return comes right after that. It's this long section called the Knife Edge Ridge or the Cowboy Arete. It's basically just this ice rib that you can't really protect. Really, really cool, but also an obvious like section in the route that kind of divides it and that you can't really reverse. And, you know, it's clear as a climber, like looking at the route, that that's the case. So yeah, we kept climbing and we got onto the knife edge and, everything was great. There were definitely like some really, really, high gusts of wind that blasted us when we were on that thing. And it was just kind of like, put your head down and get a good stance. Cause you know, we're simul climbing with no pro, like we had one picket, but it wouldn't have done anything. And like, you can maybe like dig deep into the arete and get a screw in, but it's just in sugar and it's not going to do anything. So we pretty much moved through that section. And from there you're deposited onto the Hanging Glacier, which is 14,000 feet. That's like a really good spot to stop and brew. It's like a good camp as well, but we just wanted to keep moving. 30 minutes later, when we couldn't find a spot, the weather started really turning for the worst. And this is walking up to the first rock band, the base of the first rock band. By the time we started simul climbing up into the first rock band, the weather was like so bad that we couldn't communicate. Like our faces were getting numb. So we had to stop and bivvy, and we found a little spot at the base of the first rock band right near the M-shaped rocks. It was like a little overhanging piece of rock with a little ledge that we were able to chop out just big enough to pitch our tent on.
Damn.
So we like excavated some spots for ice screws and got the picket in and just anchored down the tent. And like, yeah. My ass was hanging off the edge and Sam was on the inside, and we're basically just sitting there like getting blasted by these freight train winds, like wondering what the hell was going on and like, you know, what, yeah, like what forecast we were now getting, because we definitely weren't expecting it to be this bad. And it was pretty early on in the climb. 24 hours later, the weather was just as bad. Yeah, we had taken 3 days of food and 3 days of fuel for the climb. So we're already like a day and a half in and realizing now that we're going to really have to start rationing.
It's hard to imagine probably how uncomfortable that bivy was, but it sounds like it was not comfortable or ideal at all. Were you able to evaluate your feet, or like, were you able to stay warm? Were you able to sleep?
We were actually fine, I think, at that bivy. Like, we had light puffy pants and we each had a puffy jacket. And at this point, everything was still relatively dry. So, we were able to stay pretty warm. Definitely didn't sleep much. Basically, after we crossed the knife edge, I didn't think about my feet for the rest of the climb until we got down to 14. Not to dramatize it, but it was basically like that was kind of the least of my worries throughout the climb. It was like I really felt like we could definitely die up there. Even though I thought we were going to make it, there's so much stuff that's out of your control, particularly the avalanche hazard on those upper slopes, because these things were just getting loaded. You know, like the amount of new snow that fell from the time that we left 14 to the time that we got up there was just out of comprehension. And it was already like, it was already waist deep. The next day it would get chest deep. And we were just getting all the signs that you would normally turn around in, like shooting cracks, whooping, collapsing. It was like all the red flags. And here we are roped up with no pro between us, asking to get spit off these slopes. Yeah. My rational mind kind of kicked in and I yelled to Sam, like, dude, these slopes are so fucking loaded. What are we doing? And he looked back at me and he was like, yeah, great observation, man. Like, what are we going to do about it? And I think that really like kind of helped me just turn it off and like accept the fact that we were in this and take the punches as they came.
The team would indeed take punches the next day as they worked their way through the first rock band under a constant barrage of spindrift and 70-mile-per-hour winds. Under the second rock band, the weather turned for the worse, and they were forced into their third bivy. Out of food, and with the weather getting worse by the hour, the team considered the weight of their commitment. Going down was not an option. They had to get to the top of the Cassine at all costs.
Yeah, so we were getting these weather updates from our friend Alan back home, and basically just the forecast was getting worse, and the extended forecast was a lot worse. So we knew that waiting wasn't going to do us any good, and we really just had to get out of there. So we basically just made the decision, rather than wait and gamble with the weather getting better, which we knew in the back of our minds it wasn't going to, we just decided to get out of there and start moving. So we, yeah, managed to choose the path of least resistance through the second rock band in the middle of the night, like total whiteout. You know, it's like the climbing would have been really, really fun because like those are like the money pitches of the route. They're like these two pitches that we simul-climbed through that are just, I mean, they're so good. It's just like perfect sticks, really steep, like Scottish-esque mixed climbing through this like sweeping buttress. But yeah, I mean, my memories in there are just basically of like the worst screaming barfies I've ever experienced. Like just so numb and so cold, like shivering throughout the entire thing. And we're both in our puffies, like our big down puffies climbing through this. I don't think I've ever climbed in my puffy like that. And yeah, we both kind of like appreciated the climbing through there. Like we gave each other high fives and we kind of like noted how great the climbing was. And we're super relieved when we topped out. I think it deposits you. It's like around, I don't know, 16,000 or something, or yeah, maybe 15 something. But so we were super relieved that we were at the end of the technical climbing, mainly just because of like all the shit that we were getting hit with, from the weather being so bad. Like there was just so much stuff coming, like so much spindrift coming down these gullies and, like, yeah, so much stuff that was getting kicked off because of, the weather. And so from there, I really started to feel the effects of dehydration. I basically felt like I was moving at a snail's pace. Simul-climbing through this like last section. If anyone's familiar of the route with the route, this is, the section, like the hand crack at the very end of the second rock band. So climbing through that, I just basically felt like I was gasping for every breath. And I think Sam felt the same way, but, he also can get by with a lot less water than I can. And, when we topped out that section, I definitely knew I needed water, but, Sam was pretty cold at this point, like a lot colder than I was. And I felt like trying to stop and brew there was going to probably wasn't going to work out because it was pretty exposed, even though it's really flat and would have been ideal otherwise. So with the winds and as much snow as there was, we just decided to keep going. And at this point, you're basically traversing these slopes that had just gotten, I mean, I can't even explain how loaded they were. Like it's a miracle that we didn't get spit off in my mind. But that's on the edge of Big Bertha. So you basically are traversing around the third rock band to the right of the third rock band. The entire time he and I were just simul climbing this thing roped up with no pro, because there's no pro to be had, and we had to move. So that was super difficult. Like mentally, I think that was the most taxing part of the climb for me, because it was just so much effort. Like every step just felt like, yeah, so difficult. Again, the weather was just deteriorating on us. Like it had gotten a little bit better when we topped out the second rock band, and then throughout that traverse it just got worse and worse. And from there you're deposited basically at these gullies that lead you, these snow gullies that lead you to the upper slopes of the Cassine, which in most people's minds are just going to be a slog. And for the most part, they would have been, but with how loaded they were, we definitely had to like choose some kind of convoluted lines. Like we were doing a little bit more mixed climbing than we would have otherwise, just to stay off of these like the most loaded slopes. So that definitely took a little bit more time than we would have liked otherwise, but it was definitely necessary. And by the time we got to like around 17,000 feet, the winds were just, I mean, like we could barely stay on our feet. We didn't know how bad they were at the time because we hadn't checked weather since our last bivvy, or like we hadn't gotten an updated forecast. But this is like, yeah, the kind of winds that like can take you away. Yeah. So both of us kind of knew, and we were kind of like looking for the most ideal spot. And we kind of finally just realized like we just had to like dig in wherever we could. So again, we actually found a pretty ideal spot right on the edge of the upper snow slopes. And we were at like 17,000 feet, I believe, at this point. And we kind of chopped out a platform. Once we got the tent up and crawled inside, I had gotten a response from our friends back home, and kind of like didn't even know what to say looking at this forecast. It was like 70 mile per hour winds for the next 2 days. And our buddy Alan was like, put a picket or some screws and dig into that shit. Don't go Wizard of Oz on us.
All Although the technical difficulties were behind them now, the team still had 3,000 feet of steep snow climbing to go before they topped out on the summit ridge. Under optimal conditions, the Upper Cassine would be a big push for anyone. But as Aaron and Sam stepped out of their tent and continued up the next day, they would not have optimal conditions.
In our minds, this was like the last push. Like, there was nothing else that could have happened unless we got spit off or, you know, God forbid something bad happened to us. Like, this was it. We were going to climb from here over the top, touch the summit, and then go down the West Buttress and, like, eat burritos until our stomachs exploded at 14. And, just kind of like the rest of the climb, that turned out to be far from the case. And, we're like going through neck deep snow, soon after we left. Like, every step we took, it was like two steps backward, like tunneling through the snow. Just like the rest of the climb, once we kind of got to like our next goal, which was at this point the summit, the weather just closed in like quicker than I've ever experienced, and quicker than we had experienced at any other point in the climb. Kind of seemed like every time the night fell, which, you know, in Alaska, it's like one of the nice things climbing there, doesn't really get that dark. But it definitely seemed like every time night hit, like around 2 a.m., the weather also turned, and that's what happened here as well. So started to get a little dark on us, and the weather moved in on us, and by the time we topped out over the summit, like, we couldn't even hear each other's voices. The winds were so bad, and there was like tons of new snow falling. Yeah, pretty scary. So walking down the West Buttress, we soon realized like there was just no way that we could get down safely, because, I mean, as easy as the West Buttress is, and Sam and I have both climbed the West Buttress a bunch, like, he's guided on the West Buttress, you know, I had the waypoints programmed into my GPS even, but, like, you could just walk off the side and not even know it with the conditions we were in. So we basically bivvied on the summit ridge, when we realized that we weren't going to be able to like safely get down. And, I just remember like when I kind of solidified that was the decision, Sam just fell to his knees and like kind of put his hands in the air, like he'd seen a movie or something, but he was actually serious. Like, you know, that was like, just this thing was just kicking us down and pushing us over the limit, which was kind of funny in a messed up way. That's kind of what you get when you roll the dice with a route like this and the weather that we had. So I don't think either of us feel very sorry for ourselves, but, getting back to the chain of events, we set up the bivvy, and like, we couldn't even, it was so cold, and, the weather, it was like so serious at this point. We were so dehydrated and so just like emaciated from, like lack of nutrients that we couldn't chop anything out. We just had to like pitch the tent and like basically throw all of our shit on top of it to make sure that it didn't blow away with us in it. Yeah. Like we got in our bags and Sam promptly got hypothermic and he was like shivering really badly. And for him, I know that was the scariest point of the climb. And once I realized how serious of a place he was in and how cold he was, it was definitely the scariest for me too. So I ripped off my mitten and got the stove out and was just trying to light the stove to get him a warm bottle, like at all costs. Like, I knew I was going to get frostbite and there was no two ways around it. But basically for an hour, I like battled trying to get the stove lit to get my partner a warm water bottle. Because I didn't have any warm clothes I could have given him. You know, I was already cuddling with him. There was nothing else I could have done aside from this bottle. So I finally got it lit and got him some water, got him a little bit warm. And again, like we just waited until the visibility improved and until the winds died down. It was mainly the visibility at this point though. And yeah, basically we both kind of mutually agreed, like it didn't matter how bad it was outside at this point. And this is like 20 hours after setting up this bivy, like we had to move, like we were both getting pretty cold. Thankfully, when we poked our heads out of the tent, visibility had improved. The winds were still like super cold and biting, but at that point, like we knew we were gonna be safe.
Taking advantage of the break in the weather, the two climbers navigated their way down the Upper West Buttress and into the safety of 14 Camp. Although relieved to be done with the climb, the duo had now been out of food for days and were dangerously dehydrated. They were wasted. But as Aaron's adrenaline slowly waned into reality, he realized that Kasim wasn't going to release its icy grip easily.
I hadn't even looked at my toes at this point. I had actually honestly kind of forgotten about them throughout the climb. Like they were so numb from so early on that I just started sleeping in my boots. Like I knew if I took them off, it was just going to be super painful. So throughout pretty much the whole climb, I was sleeping in my boots. And from 17 down to 14, all I could think about was like tons of food and tons of water. Like I wasn't thinking we were going to have to get treatment or anything. I was like, we're safe. We're just going to go eat a lot and everything's going to be cool. But, you know, Sam's a nurse. And when he saw my fingers, he was like, we need to go like see the Rangers. Like this is, you know, cause they have a Ranger tent set up at 14. And I was like, ah, fuck. Yeah, you're right. You know, like I knew deep down that we needed to do that, but that was the last thing I wanted to do. So, kind of just like gingerly went over and knocked on their, tent door. It was like pretty late at this point. It's like the middle of the night. And yeah, they had been expecting us. So our good friend, Mark Puglisi was guiding a team on the West Buttress and he had been at 14,000 camp when we left for the Cassine, like 7.5 days prior, and knew that we were planning for like 3 days on the route. That's what we took provision wise as well. And, yeah, he had contacted Mark Westman, one of the Rangers up there, and like one of Sam and Alan's friends when we were up at, I think it was like our second or third bivvy, to let him know like, hey, these guys are up on the Cassine. No one's moving here at 14. Like they're in a pretty bad spot. So the Rangers were expecting us. Like they knew that we were up there and just hoping that we were going to come down. So they were just really relieved more than anything to see us and to like for us to be there, which was like a really good feeling. Yeah. They took us into the tent and, took off my boots and my toes were just like, yeah, they were pretty gnarly. It's like totally black. Both my big toes were like fully black. And, every one of my toes on my right foot was frostbitten. They're all black. Yeah, so they made the decision to de-thaw them there, which was fine. Like, didn't really feel like it hurt too bad compared to what we'd been through. I was just like super relieved to be safe. And they made us like a ton of food, like really, really good food, which was really awesome. It was just kind of crazy. Like none of that really stayed down for either Sam or I, which was like the only time I've ever experienced that, which kind of like solidified how long it had been since we'd eaten properly or had nutrients in our system. But yeah, it just felt really good to be safe.
So you're up at 14, you're getting care. What happened from there?
Mark Westman, who's one of my personal heroes, just from everything. And I've talked to him a little bit in the past and, we have a lot of mutual friends, but this is kind of like the first time I've actually kind of had like a face to face with him. That was really cool for me. Wasn't really the way I wanted to meet him, but he came over and was just the same way, like super caring about everything, and basically was the voice of reason in the whole thing. Because I was like, I was you know, like dead set walking down, like there's no way that I'm not gonna finish this thing myself. And Mark told me, you know, like, hey, we already have another guy here who needs to get helied out of here, and we have 2 seats in the chopper, and 1's filled. And if you don't go down with him, the chance of you losing at least that toe, but probably more, is like, yeah, you would just be stupid not to, you know, like he basically said, like, it probably would happen. Just because I respect him so much, I was like, okay, like if he's suggesting this and telling me I should do that, I should do it. And in retrospect, I'm so glad he was there to say that, because if he hadn't been, like, there's no way that I would have taken that chopper, and I probably, or there's a good chance that I wouldn't have one or both my toes.
Aaron was lucky. Although he's currently rock climbing in Tevas, his toes and hands are almost fully healed. He's taken the last 6 months to process the experience, and in doing so, reinforced his priorities. His dog, Dino, his friends in the Salt Lake climbing community, his family. Before we ended our conversation, I asked Aaron to reflect on some of the lessons he learned from being so committed on the Cassine, and where he's headed from here.
Throughout like the short time I've been an alpine climber relative to all of these guys that I'm fortunate enough to climb with, and like all of these, I mean, honestly, like heroes that I have that I am lucky enough to call my partners here at home. Like the more I see them, kind of like paying for their actions, the more I realize that, like, not that I'm not invincible, but it doesn't matter how good you are. Like, the mountains don't know that. And it doesn't matter how fit you are. And that, like, when you hang it out there like that, you know, you have to be ready for the consequences, and you have to be ready to, like, take the punches that are going to come. And I think if you do what we did enough, like, it's going to come around at some point, which is really like one of the things I realized from like a climbing standpoint. Like, I didn't really understand when, Kyle and Scott went missing. I was just like, how do you just disappear on a face? Like, I didn't really get it. And like, now I know, like, I fully know, like, I totally get it. And, I think that just kind of all clicked for me. Like, it can happen. And you just have to be aware of that. And the hardest thing for me to deal with was thinking of like all of the people that would have missed us and would have been impacted had we not gotten down. Like all those people I was communicating with on the sat phone, my mom especially, like I was kind of not lying to her, but like telling her that we were in a better spot than we were, but like she knew, like, she knows my bullshit, you know, she knew we were in like a really bad spot, and she was getting the weather and talking to Sam's parents, and like, yeah, I think I just realized how good my life is and how fortunate I am, and that it would impact more than just me if something were to happen.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you enjoyed Aaron's story as much as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his hard-earned wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Don't forget to review the podcast on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app, and please consider supporting The Fernline by pledging on Patreon. We had musical contributions from my good friend Andy Thulberg today. You can check him out on SoundCloud or in the show links. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear on this show, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Bandcamp, Spotify, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.